It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Later in the program, we'll be talking with an ambassador who says Africa is still important to the United States, and we should be paying attention to what's going on there. That's coming up in about half an hour.
But first, we look at the Harry Potter generation. Seems like yesterday that kids of all ages were lining up for midnight releases of the Harry Potter books and movies. Does that sound familiar?
You knew what you were doing. I thought Dumbledore would have told you something worthwhile. I thought you had a plan.
I told you everything Dumbledore told me. And in case you haven't noticed, we have found a Horcrux already.
Yeah, and we're about as close to getting rid of it as we are to finding the rest of them, aren't we?
Well, time flies, and that generation has grown up, and now they can vote. But has all that exposure to the boy wizard had an effect on the generation's politics?
Joining us now is Jack Kaczynski, a professor of political science at the University of Vermont. He conducted a national survey of college students, the results of which are published in a new book called Harry Potter and the Millennials, Research Methods and the Politics of the Muggle Generation. Jack, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much for having me on.
Well, you've written in your book that J.K. Rowling didn't set out to write a political story, at least as far as we know, and that's not really what you're interested in. But you have pointed out that this seems to have changed the way a generation thinks about the world. How did you come to that conclusion?
I've been rather fascinated with this whole idea of the role that entertainment media plays on our, you know, our views about politics, going back to, you know, watching Independence Day and the portrayal of presidents and things along those lines. And what was special about the Harry Potter series was how popular it was and how immersed members of the millennial generation became in the series. And so that provided the potential, the biggest potential, for some entertainment media in this case to have a big impact.
Now, if any entertainment medium or any brand was going to have an impact on this generation, it was Harry Potter, right? I mean, it blew away reading records. So many of these people went and so these kids went and saw the movies. How pervasive was this among that generation?
Well, we measured fandom a bit, although we have to be careful about generalizing from the college students we surveyed. But among the college students we surveyed from around the country, 35% had read all the books at least once, and a larger percentage, sorry, I don't have that number right now, but a larger percentage was willing to say that on a scale of 1 to 5, they were a 5 on Harry Potter fandom. So, you know, at the risk of being considered a geek or whatever at the time, you know, a lot of millennials were willing to say they were a big, huge fan of the Harry Potter series.
And is there something to the idea about when the millennial generation was reading these books, they were sort of more malleable, they were more open to being bent to what was these new ideas out there about the world?
Exactly. One of the reviewers, the peer reviewers of the book, mentioned that, you know, one of the strongest arguments here in the book is the theory behind this, where if you think about it as you know, you're not born with your politics. You acquire them from our culture as you develop over time. And there's a certain time when you start to become aware of politics, your adolescent years and your formative years, where you don't really have most people don't have very strong attitudes at that time about politics. And so people are more open about learning different perspectives at that time. And, looking back at my life, I know I've seen the effects on my life. I grew up in a suburb of Chicago, actually, and I developed some attitudes that I have to say came from Saturday Night Live and watching Monty Python as well. That they weren't in my environment, and it was a formative time. I was just becoming aware of politics. So the Harry Potter series hit the millennial generation right at that most vulnerable time. They became very immersed in it. They identified with the characters. And all of that adds up to a strong theoretical argument that the series would have an effect on them.
Now, before we get to specifically what Harry Potter may have changed, has there been research on other elements of pop culture? I know Star Wars, of course, gave me a deep-seated fear of banthas and bounty hunters. But have people researched what other pop culture things have done to our views?
Well, there's a lot of media effects research from people who are communication scholars who have looked at things like effects of violence. You know, it's been big in the news. There have been, you know, or on bad behavior like smoking, things along those lines. But the really hasn't. I was kind of surprised about this. There really hasn't been anything to try to look at what the connection between and pure entertainment media and people's political views were. And so that's where, this is sort of opening salvo in some research I want to do on the effect of entertainment media in general on people's politics, because it's kind of a new research frontier, actually.
So going to your study, what did you find as the primary takeaway messages from Harry Potter that these millennials soaked up?
Well, if you think about the series and think about not necessarily the overt or direct, the obvious politics, it's not trying to teach you to be liberal or, vote one way or things along those lines, but there's an awful lot of politically relevant material that then has a big impact on your politics. One of the attitudes or perspectives I find most fascinating is the authoritarian perspective. And some of your listeners may be familiar with the Milgram experiments from back in the 1950s, in an attempt to see the extent to which people would be willing to follow authority, even if it was morally wrong, if you would. And that's kind of the essence of the authoritarian personality, this obedience to authority and at the same time demeaning those who you perceive beneath you, if you would. Anyway, the research on that kind of fell by the wayside after some methodological flaws were identified with the measure of authoritarianism. But a new set of research came out that developed a very powerful measure of authoritarianism that predicted an awful lot of attitudes in our current kind of culture wars environment of politics. And anyway, the lessons in the series, if you look at it, really are anti-authoritarian, if you would. And some of the worst characters are, typical authoritarian individuals. And so,
like Dolores Umbridge, like Dolores Umbridge, or
exactly, she's the epitome of the authoritarian personality.
She's the evil kind of headmaster who takes over and makes everyone do horrible things.
Yeah, she puts up a whole wall of rules, and she is very keen on following the ministry, but at the same time, very intolerant of those she perceives as inferior. That's kind of the essence of it. Anyway, we used the measure on authoritarianism, and we thought, the lessons were pretty anti-authoritarian, and we thought maybe Harry Potter fans would take away from the series, not to be authoritarian, if you would. And indeed, we found a pretty strong relationship, a very strong relationship there between being a fan of the series and not being an authoritarian. We looked at attitudes about violence. For those who know the series know that, Harry refused to use the killing curses. One time he tried, he was mocked because he couldn't do it successfully. He was mocked by, now the Harry Potter fans are going to kill me.
Bellatrix Lestrange.
Bellatrix, thank you. One of those lame moments, all right. So there's lessons about that, and we found parallel attitudes among fans. They were less supportive of the use of deadly force, of torture, those sort of things. We also looked at, attitudes about acceptance and diversity and political tolerance, pretty key attitudes in a democratic society. And, Harry's pretty open to everyone. He doesn't judge them right away. He waits until he finds out more about them and is accepting of people. His favorite teacher is part werewolf. is a werewolf. Sorry. His friend Hagrid is half giant. And he's very accepting of individuals, of goblins, of house elves, things along those lines. And all that is reflected in the attitudes of the Harry Potter fans. So it's a lot about those, politically relevant type of attitudes that then help us understand people's politics overall.
We're talking with Jack Kaczynski, author of Harry Potter and the Millennials.
And we want to know what you think about this. Has the Harry Potter series had an effect on your political beliefs, your social beliefs, do you think? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
You can also send an email to talk@WPR.org or leave your comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll hear from you right after this break. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network Public Radio. Coming up Monday, On Point looks at democracy in Egypt. That's On Point Monday after 9.
Now let's take a look at some of the latest news from WPR's Noah Ovshinsky.
There have been violent confrontations today and into the night in Cairo and elsewhere in Egypt between supporters of ousted President Mohamed Morsi and his opponents. Across Egypt, at least 10 people have been killed. More details are being learned about just how an Arizona wildfire was able to trap a group of 19 elite firefighters last weekend. A spokesman for the crews battling the fire and another official with the Prescott Fire Department confirmed that the erratic wildfire curled around the team's location, cutting off their access to a nearby safety zone. All 19 died in the fire. And Governor Scott Walker has signed a bill that would increase the maximum weekly unemployment insurance payout, but install new limits on who can collect the benefits. The bill increases the highest monthly benefit by $7 to $370. It also makes it easier for the state to recover overpayments made to the unemployed by allowing audits of beneficiaries. More news coming up in 15 minutes.
Thanks, Noah. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We'll pick up the discussion with Jack Kaczynski and with you at 1-800-642-1234. We're curious, has the Harry Potter series changed the way that you or your kids maybe look at the world, ideas you have about authoritarianism, maybe tolerance or violence? Let us know. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234.
And Jack, you had talked just before the break about how reading Harry Potter, the people who read lots of the Harry Potter books were more prone to be more tolerant and more opposed to authoritarian things, opposed to things like the death penalty. How about political participation? Does it seem to make a difference on whether they're likely to vote and then who they're likely to vote for?
We did find a relationship between the levels of participation in voting in Harry Potter fans basically we asked the series of questions about the various forms of participation and developed a scale level of participation. And Harry Potter fans were more likely to be engaged in politics than non-Harry Potter fans, and they're also more likely to vote Democratic than, that is with a capital D, for Barack Obama in the 2008 presidential election. So it did seem to have some sort of association there as well.
Why do you think that is?
I think some of the attitudes, particularly if you look at the millennials, and there's been a lot of other research done on the millennial generation that shows that they are a pretty liberal generation, much more liberal than the predecessors. The previous generations, if you would. And in fact, you know, two-thirds of millennials voted for Barack Obama in 2008. And I think, you know, the Harry Potter series added to that kind of attitude about openness of diversity and acceptance and tolerance. And you can see it reflected in attitudes about things such as same-sex marriage, that, you know, in terms of support for that in our culture. You know, the lessons, I think, there's some relationship there from the Harry Potter series. Those kind of attitudes are more prevalent among Democrats, and so the Harry Potter fans ended up supporting Barack Obama more.
Jack, what convinced you that the views that these millennials have, the ones we're hearing about now, are down to Harry Potter and the influence that Harry Potter had, instead of Harry Potter and the millennials all being part of the same zeitgeist and the way that the world was spinning at that particular span of years?
That's a great question. That's kind of at the heart of a lot of the discussion of this book, because the question is, in essence, one of causality and one of, you know, how much did Harry Potter contribute compared to a lot of the other factors that shaped millennials growing up. And certainly, listeners hopefully don't think that I'm saying, you know, Harry Potter alone explains why the millennials are the way they are politically. It's just one of the many factors that contributed to the formation of their attitudes. And the key is, in the book, we do some analysis where we control for a number of other factors that might explain the attitudes of millennials. And what we find is, even while controlling for those factors, Harry Potter fans are different from non-Harry Potter fans among millennials. And that's kind of the key, you know, that Harry Potter fans compared to other non-fans in their own generation are different on all of these lessons that can be found, if you would, political lessons, politically relevant lessons that can be found in the book, in the Harry Potter series.
And how do you know that it isn't just that kids whose parents give them the Harry Potter books. You know, like maybe there's something about being raised in an environment where you'd be have that book put in your hand in the first place may have mm-hmm. those outcomes.
Well, you have to, there's a number of different answers to that question. One is, you know, the series was so popular and most of the people we interviewed didn't come to reading the series from their parents. They heard about it other ways. So that's one piece that would contradict that point. The other is, if you look how liberal this generation is compared to previous generations, they're much more liberal than the baby boom generation, which would mainly be their parents, if you would. So something was going on here to distinguish that. And, it hit them in the formative years. And it's also one other possibility, you know, even if parents did encourage their children to read it, you know, it's probably because they wanted them to read and they heard from others that, wow, this series gets my children to read. And indeed, the series had a powerful effect on the millennials in terms of getting them to be readers. I have one. Oh, finally, the other thing is the reinforcement of attitudes is also very important. So in the case of those whose parents probably agree with the values in the book in the first place, the fact that the books might have reinforced those attitudes would strengthen their perspectives on those attitudes and more likely make Harry Potter fans act based on those attitudes than if they weren't reinforced from these kind of stories, if you would.
Now, I suppose you could have had politicians during these years spouting these same kinds of ideas about attitudes toward violence and authoritarianism and tolerance, but they were encoded in a book, in a story. So is the takeaway here that, you know, the power of storytelling is really not to be underestimated?
I would definitely agree with that. All of our stories have it's just the nature of storytelling that there are lessons that are learned by the main characters. You identify with the main characters. You get immersed in the stories. We're likely to adopt those views, and we're doing this for enjoyment. On top of that, so we're not like consciously trying to learn these lessons. The point is, we sort of learn them incidentally to the activity of watching a movie, reading a book, those sort of things, and. You know, in some ways, it could be argued those sort of shows are more likely to have an effect because our defenses are down. We're just having a good time. We're just watching a movie. We're not going to try to counter argue any political message or politically relevant message we get in those. So the potential for even a stronger effect than say watching the news is actually there in these days.
We've got Michelle in Madison on the line. Michelle, hi. You're on the air.
Hi, I was just calling in because I wanted to mention I have a niece who lives in Washington, and she was a huge Harry Potter fan, read the books many, many times. And when she was in high school, she did several missions to Tijuana building houses, and she just left. She's going to be a senior at Western Washington this fall. She just left yesterday for Rwanda, and she's going to be in a program called Building Bridges, and she's there for 6 weeks. She gets college credit for it, and it just seems like if there was an influence in her life, Harry Potter might have been one of them. Her dad, my brother, used to be very liberal when he was growing up, but he sort of took a right turn. So I'm not sure if he had as much of influence on her as some other things. And I think it's possible that it did influence her.
Thanks. Thanks for the call, Michelle. And Michelle, Jack brings up a really interesting point. We talked a little bit about political activism or at least voting behavior among Harry Potter fans versus non-fans. How about social activism, like Michelle was just talking about?
Definitely. In fact, if you look at there is a bit of a Harry Potter community. Maybe that's an underestimate too. underestimation to say a bit of a community there that. Harry Potter fans, you know, are activated to do good, if you would, and that is also one of the lessons of the series. And so what Michelle said, I would have to believe that at least in some ways the stories might have reinforced her, I think she said niece, in what her activity to try to improve the world, to do something, to be active, if you would.
We've got just a couple minutes left, Jack, and I wanted to ask, what's next? How do you start trying to tease this out for Harry Potter and its influence, and maybe for other parts of popular culture?
Oh, I just gave a paper at a conference in Chicago on two different papers that I worked on with students on other entertainment venues. One, we this interesting experiment looking at how the portrayal of villains might affect our attitudes about policies for fighting terrorism, say, using drones, or also for criminal justice policy as well. And in this experiment, we took a look. We try to activate people's thinking about different sort of types of villains, and we actually found that we were able to experimentally manipulate people's attitudes about, you know, terrorism or about criminal justice based on that sort of thing. The villains, we show them pictures of villains. So that's one possible route to go, look at more of this kind of entertainment media. But, you know, in the Harry Potter, we were focusing largely on, you know, the overall story and the heroic nature of Harry and his friends. But, you know, there's a flip side, too. When bad guys are portrayed, and if they're portrayed as just unredeeming, heinous individuals, does that mean we're more likely to support the death penalty, if you would? It's interesting because in our country we have overwhelming support for the death penalty compared to other nations. And my question would be, does any of that come from entertainment media?
That's an interesting place. I will leave it there, but we'll keep an eye out for your future research. Jack, thanks so much for joining us today.
Howard, thank you very much, Rob, and thank you, Veronica. It was great talking about this.
That was Jack Krasinski, a professor of political science at the University of Vermont, and his book is called Harry Potter and the Millennials.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk with an ambassador who says that Africa is still important to the United States and we should be paying attention to what's going on there. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcome to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Today on Central Time, it's Food Friday, and we'll talk to Chris Kimball of America's Test Kitchen. That's coming up in about 10 minutes.
First, President Obama was in Africa earlier this week in his second visit since he was elected. That got the U.S. media's attention for a few days.
Our next guest says he hopes the media and the American public pay more attention to Africa and clear up some myths and misconceptions. Ambassador Johnny Carson joins us now. He was Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs until March. He's also served as an ambassador to a number of African nations. He's now with the United States Institute for Peace. Ambassador Carson, welcome to the show.
Rob, thank you. Glad to be with you this afternoon.
Now, we usually only see the bad news that comes out of Africa, disease, famine, and war. Does that view from the media give us a skewed impression?
Rob, I think it does. I think Africa is changing, and Africa is changing very rapidly and in a positive direction. Democracy is on the rise and gaining a stronger and stronger foothold across sub-Saharan Africa. The number of crises in Africa have declined over the last two decades, and we have seen Africa emerge as a great pole of economic growth. Recently, the World Bank indicated that six of the 10 fastest-growing countries and economies in the world are located in Africa, and 10 of the top 20. Africa should be a destination for American business, American investment, and for American trade.
It should be, but is it?
It can be, and it should be. I think there are two things that are needed. One is greater interest on the part of American companies, large, medium, and small, and an increasingly more positive regulatory environments from African countries as well. Many of our major corporations are doing business in Africa. Boeing, for example, sells its airplanes to the top airlines across the continent, South Africa Airways, Kenya Airways, Ethiopia Airways, Air Morocco, and Air Egypt. General Electric sells many products across the continent, and some of our consumer companies like Coca-Cola do a lot of business there. But as President Obama pointed out, it's time for some of our energy companies to get into the business as well. Not only in pumping oil and gas out of the continent, but also helping to set up transmission and distribution and generation of power, which is vastly needed across the continent.
You mentioned a few moments ago that we see a rise in democracy around Africa. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Sure can. President Obama's trip to Senegal, South Africa, and Tanzania was an opportunity to acknowledge and applaud the democratic progress that has occurred not only in those three countries, but also in many others across the continent. In Senegal, we saw President Macky Sall defeat the outgoing president, Mr. Wade.
Sounds like we've lost Ambassador Carson. We'll try redialing him in just a moment. I'll say coming up in just a few minutes, we've got Chris Kimball with America's Test Kitchen. He'll have some recipes, I believe, tell us a little bit about how astronauts eat in space. And if I'm not mistaken, we might get a margarita recipe from him. That's coming up with Chris Kimball in just a few minutes. They're redialing Ambassador Carson, one of the joys of live radio here. Look around for a thumbs up from Chris. Yes? No? We'll be back on Central Time coming up on Monday. Do you remember off the top of your head, Veronica? Oh, no, here we go. We've got Ambassador Carson online. Ambassador Carson, are you there?
I am.
We lost you from the line there. Yeah, okay. So you were in the midst of telling us the story of democracy's progress in Africa and orderly transitions of power handed over in elections.
We've seen over the last decade sitting presidents lose elections and step aside quietly and peacefully. We've seen presidents die in office, and we've seen their successors move into the presidency without interruption or disruption. We've seen very tight and highly contested elections in places like Liberia and in Kenya and in Nigeria, and in each of those instances, the opposition stepped aside, and the winners were allowed to take their place. We've seen a decrease in the number of military coup d'états across the continent, and all the polling data that we see, and it's quite good, indicates that Africans support democracy and representative governments.
I wanted to take our last minute or two to talk about Nelson Mandela. We're watching the news. He is apparently in very poor health, has been for some time. Can you, as a former ambassador in Africa, can you talk about his influence across sub-Saharan Africa?
There is no doubt in my mind that Nelson Mandela is probably the most significant political figure in Africa over the last 60 years. His dignity in coming out of jail after 27 years and leading South Africa to a new political dispensation that ended apartheid stands out as one of the major political achievements, not only in Africa but globally over the last 50 or 60 years. No one, no political figure has the stature or the dignity or respect of Nelson Mandela. He is a personal political icon and hero for many Africans and for many around the world who believe in democracy, respect for human rights, and human dignity.
And just briefly, do you think he's inspired leaders around the continent to emulate his example?
I think he is a part of the democracy wave that we are seeing. His willingness to come in, be elected, serve for one term, and step down has helped to give the democracy a very, very strong and powerful symbol and figure.
Ambassador Carson, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Ambassador Johnny Carson. He's former Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. By the way, he wrote a piece that was on CNN, and I just threw a link up on our Facebook page, the Central Time Facebook page, before we went on the air.
And coming up, we'll talk to Chris Kimball of America's Test Kitchen. He has some cooking advice and a tasty margarita recipe. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Monday, Joy Cardine talks with Wisconsin Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen about the state budget and a lot more. That's Monday after 7 on The Joy Cardine Show.
Noah Ovshinsky joins us now, and he's got a look at some headlines we're keeping an eye on. Thanks, Noah. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Time for Food Friday, the Sunday you might hear a new yet familiar voice on our airwaves.
Chris Kimball is the host of America's Test Kitchen Radio, one of the brand new shows coming to the Ideas Network, and he's here with us now to give us a sneak peek.
And Chris, what should we look forward to hearing on the radio show that you're really excited about?
Well, first of all, radio is 10 times harder than television and 10 times more interesting because you can go so much farther afield in the kitchen and do so many more things. So it's sort of the show we've always wanted to do but never really could because on television, which we love, but you're showing how to make a recipe or two. And you can't stray too far because you need to keep the continuity of the cooking. Our show has lots of different segments. We do call-ins. I do an interview segment where I talked to Ron Finley this week, who's the Gorilla Gardener of South Central LA. We've talked to experts on dogs. We've talked to people about cognition and the brain and taste and how all that works. Talked to Mary Roach about her book on astronauts and how they cook in space and her new book, Gulp, you know, about the digestive system. So that's good. We do a wine segment where we don't just taste wines. We sort of explore a particular topic. That's great. We do tastings. We do gadget reviews. We do a recipe challenge every week. You know, it's just a lot of different things, and it's we stay away from doing much real cooking because you can't really, I think, cook effectively on the radio. But there's a whole bunch of other topics around that are really fun.
So you really cover a broad range of topics, and I want to ask you about the cooking part. You know, at least for food shows as we know it, think the Food Channel or PBS food shows, you know, you see this frying pan and the oil sizzling, the steak in the pan, and you can't smell it, but it's still as close to a sensual food experience as you can get without being there and sticking your hands in the dough. For radio, how do you make food come alive?
Well, first of all, food in the last 30 years or 20 years has come a long way from just watching Julia Child cook. So if you think about two people sitting in a bar having a beer, you know, and talking about food, there's just a whole bunch of topics that make sense.
So we have come a long way since Julia Child and even, you know, the content on the Food Network, which is largely visually based. You kind of get excited just looking at the food. But I suppose you kind of got the whole theater of the mind that you said has no limits. When you're talking about a show like yours, you can just talk about it and imagine astronaut food or whatever it is you're diving into that day.
Well, yeah, you talk to Mary Roach, who's just hysterically funny, about how astronauts eat. And there's no gravity, of course. And one of the things they found out was that originally they didn't have a table because, of course, it makes no sense to sit in a table when there's no gravity, right? You just, like, float around and eat. So, but the astronauts liked the idea of sitting around for dinner, you know, for meals. So they actually put a table in with Velcro seats, you know, so you could sit down. And then the kinds of food and how do you create food because you can't have crumbs, you know, because crumbs float all over and get into the instruments. And, you know, it's just an interesting – it's a starting point. And if you think about the Food Network, you know, the Food Network really isn't about cooking, is it? I mean, it's about all the surround. And so, sure, people are cooking, but it's sort of like Car Talk isn't about cars, you know. The Food Network really isn't about food or isn't about cooking. It's about everything else around it. It's just a common entry point. So I think the food certainly has plenty of things you can do. I mean, on Car Talk, they don't actually fix cars.
Right.
They talk about cars, and the cars are a starting point for a conversation. And I think radio, I mean, you know this, radio is about narrative. It's about storytelling. So you have to be able to tell creative stories with food as a starting point, but you're telling stories, and that's what makes good radio, and that's hard, very hard to do well. It's really an art.
Do you think that we're ripe culturally for a show like this, a radio show like this right now? It seems to me that more and more people are interested in cooking and want to talk about it at any level, at any entry point. Is it time for this right now?
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, I remember 2 years ago when we started working on the show, and I would talk to some producers, and they'd say, well, we have a food show. And I said, that's kind of like saying to the Food Network, oh, we have a cooking show. I mean, it's like, yeah, okay, but... You know, it's like one of the big topics of conversation in this country. And look at the number of books published about it, or look at the number of blogs or the websites. I mean, everyone talks about food. There's thousands of entry points into the topic. One show on food seems kind of silly because there's no such thing as just a food show. You could do 100 different kinds of food shows. And so, sure, I think people should use it as a jumping off point. I can imagine dozens of ways of doing food shows.
The only thing that bums me out about your show being on the radio is that nobody can see your bow tie.
Well, you know, I think the great thing about radio is you can imagine it, you know. So the idea of thinking about that visually is probably more impressive than actually seeing it. So it's the virtual bow tie, right?
Yeah, I don't know, you've got some pretty cool bow ties there that I've seen.
I have quite a collection, yes. I have well over 100, so in all shapes, sizes, and colors.
You may need a Mr. Rogers-type segment where you describe the bow tie of the hour.
It's funny you should mention that, because I've always talked about the show, you know, sort of like Mr. Rogers, like it's comfortable, you know what to expect.
Yeah.
He just outlasted the competition, right? I mean, he just kept going. And I think, you know, in public media, I have to say, I love it for a variety of reasons, but it gives you an opportunity to find an audience slowly and then build and then really do things that would never necessarily work in a commercial environment because you have about 2 weeks to make it work. And there's something to be said for slowly developing an editorial product, TV or radio, and finding an audience. And I think that one of the great strengths of public media is exactly that. I mean, Mr. Rogers, I don't know how he did in his first year. Probably it took him a few years to sort of develop the show. And I think that's what's great. I mean, commercial media is so, you know, you have 5 days to sort of make your numbers. And that's what's one of the great things about public media.
Chris, you've been involved in food for years and years, deeply involved. You've written cookbooks. You've launched influential food magazines like Cooks Illustrated. Are you still as excited about food now as you ever were now that you've...
Oh, yeah. I am in the last 2 years. I mean, for a while, I mean, I used to cook all the time because I was doing cookbooks and other things. I love to cook, and my kids were young. And then I would say there was a period where I was doing less cooking because I was so busy with the business and other things. And now, last 2 years, I've really gotten back into it, and I cook almost every night. And because I've changed my cooking style, I've really branched out more. And I just love it now because I have the basics down by this time. And I'm really interested in new ways of looking at cooking. And I found that most of what I've learned is of a piece, you know, it's got the Northern European tradition mostly. And then I picked up sort of Southern European. But there's all this other ways of thinking about putting food together, you know, Southern Mediterranean, Turkey, Morocco, other places. And it's just it's not just different spices, it's just thinking about food in totally different ways. And that's really exciting because you never get to the end, you know. So you go through iterations with food. You know, you sort of get to the end of one act and you get to the next. And I don't know which act I'm in now, but it's really interesting because it's not just about how to hold a knife now. It's about, oh, I see. So you can think about putting food together in a different way entirely. And I eat many more grains and salads and things than I used to. So, you know, like tabbouleh is a variation on a very long tradition. And so you think about parsley, and you think about bulgur, and you think about all these things and how they go together and how to combine flavors. And, you know, you learn every time you step in the kitchen. It's great.
Yeah, that's perfectly said. It makes me get excited about cooking again. And I know that this summer is a huge cooking season. Is there a recipe, one that you're excited about right now that you could share with us and maybe we could post on our Facebook site?
Sure. Let's see. It would be particularly summery. Actually, you know, the thing I just did this recently is, and it's not a new recipe for us, it's our margarita recipe. But it starts, it's really interesting because you take a standing mixer and you take limes and lemons and you juice them using the paddle attachment. And so it takes just like 15 seconds and you juice, you know, you can juice a dozen limes and lemons. And it's one part triple sec, one part tequila, and one part the juice of the limes and lemons, 4 teaspoons each of the zest from each of them, and 1/4 cup of sugar. And the secret is you let that juice and sugar sit for at least 4 hours or overnight. You just let it sit in the refrigerator, and it mellows out the acidity and gives you a deeper lime and lemon flavor. Then you combine it the next day with a tequila and a triple sec, and it's just spectacular. It's really good.
And it's from Chris Kimball, so you know it's going to be good.
This is the world's best margarita, yeah.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for talking today. Appreciate it.
Yeah, great pleasure. Thank you.
That was Chris Kimball with America's Test Kitchen Radio. You can hear him on that show here on the Ideas Network, Sundays at 10 a.m.
And we've got a link to that delicious-sounding margarita recipe that you may want to try out this weekend on the Central Time Facebook page.
I really want to try it. My one concern is that it involves a lot of premeditation. You've got to, like, he wants you to have the lime and the lemon sitting for 4 hours or overnight, and when I want a margarita, I want it now.
Come on, Rob.
Yeah.
You got to wait for good things.
I will try it out sometime, and maybe I'll even be patient and do it the way he suggested. Maybe even this weekend.
If you try out the recipe and let us know, give us a holler on the Facebook page. Let us know how it is. And something else you can do on the Central Time Facebook page. Just yesterday, we launched our first Curious Wisconsin segment, mm-hmm. where we answer questions about quirky things in the state that you might be wondering about, you might want an answer to. Rob, yesterday's question was yours.
Mine, about why the big M is by the hill in Platteville. It turns out the answer is mining. It was in honor of what was then a thriving mining industry in Platteville. And so we got the answer to that. Now it's your turn. Either on the Central Time Facebook page, you can leave your Curious Wisconsin question, or we've got to tell you about our hotline. You can call 855-683-5422. That's 855-683-5422. Leave us a message and share your question, the thing that you are curious about in Wisconsin.
And coming up Monday on Central Time, we'll be joined by Wisconsin's own Fox. The band has got quite a following in Wisconsin and beyond, and they'll be dropping by to play us a few songs live from our very own Buck Studio. That's coming up Monday during our 4 o'clock hour.
We'll also be talking about the potential problems that arise from using birdsong apps out in nature, how our utensils affect the taste of our food, and a coming Arctic economic boom.
That's all coming up on Monday's broadcast of Central Time.